Welcome to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are writer and memoirist Danny Shapiro and author and professor of medicine Dr. Abraham Verghese. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces our guests.
Now, I'm sure you are as delighted as we are to have Danny Shapiro here with us this evening, the author of the instant New York Times bestseller Inheritance, as well as several other best-selling and critically acclaimed memoirs and novels. Danny's also the host of the hit podcast, Family Secrets. And tonight, we are thrilled to host a live episode of Family Secrets, featuring Danny's very special guest, Dr. Abraham Verghese, professor and vice chair for the theory and practice of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine, and the best-selling author of Cutting for Stone, among others. Family Secrets. As Danny Shapiro knows from personal experience, as a memoirist, and as the host of a podcast that's been listened to by almost 10 million people and counting, family secrets are something we all have in common. And while the discovery of a family secret can initially be terrifying or traumatic, often these discoveries have the power to liberate, heal, and even uplift us. Danny Shapiro and Abraham Verghese will be talking tonight about the extraordinary lessons the truth can teach us. And now, without further ado, let's bring out our special guests, Danny Shapiro and Dr. Abraham Verghese.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. How wonderful to see such a great turnout. And I love coming here. I love the way the staff of JCC puts events together, truly. Such a blessing. And I know why you're out here in such full force. You have a treat tonight to hear from Danny Shapiro. I've had the great honor of knowing her for over a decade now, and her husband, Michael, and to take such pride in watching her go from strength to strength, and especially with this new book. It came out in hardback last year, and it has just come out in paperback. So, Danny, welcome to the Bay Area. It's so good to see you.
Abraham, it's such a treat. It's a treat to be with all of you, and it's an honor to have this conversation with you. You are one of my favorite authors, and you were long before I met you. When I met you, it was the thought that we would be in a conversation like this was beyond my wildest dreams, so I'm very grateful to you for this. Is our second public conversation that we're having about
it. It is. You're very kind, but we're here to talk about you today. I want to launch into this with a quote that was in your book, said by someone in the book, because I think it embodies not just what this book is about, but what a lot of your writing has been about. And this is a quote from someone that we both admire, and that is Pema Chodron, a Buddhist monk. And she has this to say: "To be fully alive, fully human, and completely awake is to be continually thrown out of the nest. To live fully is to always be in no man's land." And when I think of your writing, I think you and most of us have had many times when we're thrown out of the nest and we're in no man's land. I'm thinking of the death of your father and many other events in your life. But this particular event that is the genesis of this book, I don't think is something that anyone could have predicted would be the thing that you write about. So for the very, very few readers who don't know what this book is about, just share for us the genesis of that moment that then led to everything that followed.
Sure. So in the winter of 2016, my husband turned to me one day and he said, "I'm going to order one of those DNA kits. Do you want to do it too? Prices have come way down." It was just a recreational thing to do, the all in good fun. He was interested in exploring a little bit more of family history. His parents were ailing, and he thought it would make a connection, something to talk about. And I'm haunted now by the fact that I could so easily have said no, because it didn't interest me. I thought I knew everything that there was to know about where I came from. But instead I said yes and spit into the plastic vial, and we sent it off through the mail, and a couple of months later, my results were returned, and they didn't make sense, just in terms of what I understood my own ethnicity to be. And in fairly short order, I came to the crushing and shocking realization that my dad had not been my biological father.
You know, so this is a profound thing for anybody to discover, but I think just knowing you and knowing your tradition and how much you value that, and I want to just read a passage just to remind all of us who you are, not that anybody needs reminding. You say in the book about your Jewish identity, "I am the 10th and youngest grandchild of Joseph Shapiro, self-made industrialist, philanthropist, a leader of modern orthodoxy. I'm the 10th and youngest grandchild of Beatrice Shapiro, his beautiful, gracious wife, who was admired and emulated by religious women of her generation the world over. I'm the daughter of their oldest son, Paul. Everything I am, everything I know to be true, begins with these facts." And yet those facts were turned on their head. But as it turned out, and I think this is the fascinating part, even though this was a revelation to you, there were tantalizing clues that your parents and maybe other people did know. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's interesting to understand it from where I sit now, because in the light of what I know, I can see that it was always there. I looked very different from my father's family. I was raised in this observant Jewish home, and I was raised in a very Jewish world, and every day I was told that I didn't look Jewish. Really every day. And I think the impact that had on me was that it made me feel like an outsider. I didn't know why people would be saying that. And there were other clues. There was a sense that there was secrecy in my childhood home. I supplied a lot of narratives over the years to why that might be the case. My parents, it seemed, lived in a kind of painful, closed way. And, you know, it's interesting because I've had reason lately. I was writing a craft talk a couple of weeks ago to deliver at a writer's conference, and I decided to write it on, I titled it Obsession, Theme, and the Unthought Known. And I went back and I reread my early work. And from my first novel that I wrote when I was 26 years old, even to my earlier stabs at writing fiction, I can see now that in some way I knew, even though I never even remotely entertained the thought that my dad wasn't my biological father, it was present. And I think as a writer, I was always trying to engage with, what is this thing I don't know? Why do I feel like an outsider when I'm such an insider? Why do I feel other and different and like there's something I can't apprehend?
I think as writers, we might have that feeling and then have it burst through the subconscious and become manifest in the writing. But in this case, it became manifest in a report from Ancestry.com, is how you first knew. There's a phrase that you use that I confess I never knew before, used in psychoanalysis, the known unknown.
The unthought known.
The unthought known.
Yeah.
Talk more about that, if you would.
Yeah, it was coined by a psychoanalyst named Christopher Bolas. He's written about it extensively. And the unthought known is what we know, like what we know in our bodies, what we know in our bones. You know, we talk about gut instincts and, you know, sort of what we know but is too dangerous to think. And so, in a way, Carl Jung once wrote, until we make the unconscious conscious. It will direct our lives, and we will call it fate. And in a way, I connect that very much to the unthought known. I think my whole life, in a way, was formed by it, but formed by something that I couldn't think or articulate to myself.
You know, you said earlier that you could have easily said no to the test. I think I know the answer to this, because I think self-knowledge is something we all want, even if it's painful. But if you had to do it over again, would you wish you'd said no?
No, I can't. I've thought about it so much. I think my husband felt badly for a little while for making the suggestion that sort of upended my life. But I actually feel like it's almost, not almost, it is completely liberating, ultimately, to know this thing that was in the shadows, that was forming me. I mean, it's one thing to be told early in life, you know, I've come to realize that our identities are formed very much by the stories that we're told when we're very young. And if the story is, for example, adoptees who are told at a very early age that they were adopted, that becomes part of their narrative, their own personal sense of identity. And when they grow up not looking like their parents or having a sense of otherness, they know why. I'm not remotely saying that that is easy or simple, but there's an adoption phrase, genealogical bewilderment. They know why they're bewildered. Yeah. If you're not told as a child the truth of your genetic identity, your identity is being formed around something that is actually not solid. And so I was raised with this sense of something not quite being right and not knowing why.
Yeah.
And once I knew, and once I got through kind of the wall of pain that I needed to walk through, more than a wall, it was like a field of it. It took a while. The feeling of knowledge, especially for me, someone who spent my life as a writer, grappling with family, grappling with identity, it's what I was trying to figure out my parents, trying to understand something about me that did not completely add up. And then it was like putting on exactly the right prescription glasses for the first time and realizing that the world had been blurry, and now it was like crystal clear.
Yeah, wow. You know, the last time we talked on stage, I had just received my kit to do this, and was debating it, but I gave it a great deal of thought, and I for the same reason, self-knowledge. It's a form of self-knowledge, and even if it would be painful, I think it'd be more important to know. And I'm just curious, how many in the audience have done this version of Ancestry.com, 23andMe?
Yeah. A whole wave of hands have just gone up.
I can't see you too well, but I see a lot of hands, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
So the most heroic figure in many ways in your book is your father,
yeah.
Without diminishing anybody else in the book. I mean, he clearly was an extraordinary man, but the extent of his extraordinariness was not even something you would have known till that moment. And, you know, you wrote about something else that he'd done that was truly extraordinary, that made him a hero in The New Yorker. You wrote about his very brief marriage to a woman who was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, something she held back from him until the marriage had been set. And
actually, she didn't know.
She didn't know. Sorry. Please tell us the story.
No. What's so interesting is my father was really, I think, a victim twice in his life of, at that time, a world in which people weren't told the truth, especially by doctors, about their, and they didn't want to know the truth. So she was a 26-year-old young woman. She had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Her parents knew, mm-hmm. And they kept it from her, mm-hmm. and they kept it from my dad as well. So he found out right before their wedding, and he moved forth and married her because he was madly in love with her, I came to understand when I reported that piece in The New Yorker. And he was given an out. He went to see Menachem Schneerson, the great Lubavitcher Rebbe, for rabbinical advice. And the Rebbe said to my father, postpone and postpone. Like, don't marry her, postpone. which I had a hard time understanding because it seemed so cruel. I came to understand it as what the Rebbe was trying to say to my father was, you're going to be... my father had been married prior to that and had a daughter. So in the Orthodox world, he was divorced, he had a child, and now he would also be a widower. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of marks against someone. Mm-hmm. You know, his name was Paul, and I heard when I was reporting that piece, this is years ago, for the New Yorker, that people sometimes referred to him as poor Paul. You know, and so he then married my mother, and then they struggled to have a child, and it was him. It probably was both of them, because they were. My mother was of advanced maternal age. Mm-hmm. She was nearly 40 when I was born. But we're going to get into this, but the way that doctors would speak mm-hmm. about infertility and all of that, I think he became, for a second time in his life, caught up in a little bit of a, euphemism and, you know, kind of a lack of understanding maybe of exactly what was going on, because there was a lot of obfuscation in that world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because one of the fascinating characters in the book is Dr. Edmund Farris, who ran this infertility center in Philadelphia, and your mother almost in passing mentions that you were conceived in Philadelphia, and that's the only tantalizing clue that I think you had ahead of time. But let's talk about what took your parents there and what must have transpired. And Farris, by the way, fascinates me because he was so much out of the mainstream of medicine, and yet, paradoxically, he was a pioneer in a few things that he did do.
Yeah, he's such an interesting character. I've continued to learn so much about him. And, you know, one of the gifts of this journey for me is that I had to think of my parents as people. We don't have to do that very often. As people before me, people who existed in the world with their own dreams and their own desires and their own shame and their own sorrows and their own relationship, I had to think of them as people of their time, because when I first discovered that it seemed that they had kept the truth of my identity hidden from me, I felt really betrayed. I didn't understand how they could have done that. And part of the journey for me was coming to realize that I could not judge the past by the standards of the present. There's this beautiful term in bioethics that I learned, which is retrospective moral judgment.
Presentism, right?
Presentism, I write in the book. And at that time, my parents were New Yorkers. They had moved to New Jersey. They were quite known in the world in New York. If they had gone to... There were places that did, infertility treatments in New York. There was the Sanger Clinic. There was, I believe, NYU. There was Yale, just in New Haven. It was a puzzle to me initially. Like, why Philadelphia? And why this outlier institute? It was on the campus of Penn. It was not affiliated with Penn. But Dr. Edmund Farris had been very much affiliated with Penn. He had been the director of a famous scientific research institute called the Wister Institute at Penn. And he had been ousted from it because, in fact, he was not an MD. And so he was...
Was that why he was ousted? Or
yes.
A
couple of reasons. He was not well-liked. His colleagues did not like him. He was described by someone that I spoke with as Napoleonic and with sharp elbows.
That sounds like a lot of my colleagues, actually.
But,
I hope they're not listening. I'm just kidding. Okay.
You're listening to writer and memoirist Danny Shapiro, whose book is Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love, and author and professor of medicine, Dr. Abraham Verghese, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It's It's a surreal environment. It's almost unbelievable. But Worcester was known for the largest, get ready for this, the largest colony of albino rats.
I know. I've worked with them.
Right? And so Ferris used, you know, was able to use this huge colony of rats in order to do a lot of his scientific research, and he pioneered a method by which he could discern when a woman would be at the peak of her ovulation cycle, which was very early for this. It eventually became the LH test, which is, you know, still to this day, right, used, but he never got credit for that because he was practicing medicine without a license. The Roman Catholic Church in Philadelphia, very powerful, caught wind of the fact that he was performing, you know, artificial insemination, which would have been completely against their beliefs. And so he was ousted, and he just went down the road. His colleagues did not know this. I ended up interviewing an elderly doctor who had known Ferris. When I said to him he opened his own institute, it was actually, it existed for about 15 years. And this doctor said, no, no, that's impossible. He couldn't have done it. I would have known that. I said, no, it's definitely possible. I'm here to tell you it's possible. But my parents, I think, ended up there probably because they wanted to go far afield from their own community. And also my mother was very good at figuring out how to get things done. And Ferris was nothing if not effective. Mm-hmm.
And the understand and even the concept of male infertility was sort of new for its time, because the sexism of that era would have blamed the woman initially.
And that's why he was so disliked in the medical community, because he understood that very often the issue was with the male, mm-hmm. and it was so much easier to actually figure that out. All you'd have to do is look at sperm under a microscope, but right. doctors didn't. But he did something interesting. He did identify male infertility, but then he went to great pains to make any man in his office feel that he was fertile. He would never tell a man that he was sterile, ever. He always wanted the husband to have the hope that the child was biologically his.
Which in its own perverse way was a kind of kindness, I would imagine. Don't
I'm
you think?
Sure that that's exactly yeah. how it was intended. And yeah. so for those of you who don't know this, there was a practice in those days where they would mix the donor sperm with the sperm of the husband. Mm-hmm. And it had a term, it was called confused artificial insemination. It really was, or CAI for short. And the purpose was to make yeah. the husband feel that it was possible that he was the biological father of yeah. the child. From a retrospective moral judgment standpoint, it created an enormous amount of confusion, I think, for everyone, mm-hmm. because a family would be operating under this, in this kind of like gray area always.
And I don't think they could have conceived of a time when we could do genomic testing the way we do now. Yeah. Talk a little bit about how you then tracked down the biological contributor of the sperm, who you call in the book Dr. Ben Walden.
So from the moment that I discovered that my dad had not been my biological father until the moment that I found and discovered and identified the man who was, took 36 hours.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And that part of my story actually happened right here in San Francisco. My husband and I were in Connecticut, where we live, when the results came back, and I had this realization. We were traveling the next day, which was a very surreal thing to do, because we were moving through airports, and every man of a certain age that I would pass on the moving walkway, I would feel like, you know that children's book, you know, are you my mother? Are you my mother? It was the strangest and most surreal and kind of self-alienating feeling, like, who is my biological father? I thought I knew for 54 years and now I don't, and will I ever know? And then we were coming to San Francisco, we were staying in Japantown, And in this rapid succession, my mother having let it slip that I was conceived in Philadelphia, being able to figure out the institute based on that, and then there was a first cousin who appeared on my Ancestry.com page, and then using Facebook and Google and some hunches, was able to zero in. My biological father's nephew had his DNA mapped, you know, by Ancestry.com, so he had shown up as a first cousin. So reverse engineering, if you're my first cousin, then an uncle of yours would be my biological father. And the first time I laid eyes on Ben Walden, it was on a YouTube video. He was lecturing at a university in the Pacific Northwest. He was a retired... I went from my father's been dead since I was 23 years old in 36 hours to my biological father is living and he's a total stranger and I'm looking at a YouTube video and I'm seeing myself in a stranger. It will probably remain the most surreal thing that's ever happened or ever will happen in my life. He was lecturing, which is something I do all the time, and he was standing behind a podium. He was running a Q&A, and what I noticed was that he was gesturing with his hands as he spoke.
Just like you are now.
Just like I do.
Yeah.
And I noticed nothing else. I just saw the familiar. I saw the utterly familiar in a perfect stranger. And there it was. I mean, the nature piece was just unmistakable.
That's an incredible story. I think the real, you know, the real beauty of this book is in your trying to sort of reconcile this fact with your religious beliefs, with your strong sense of tradition. And you meet a couple of rabbis in the course of this. You seek their advice. And I love what... is it Rabbi Luchstein who says to you, which story would ease your heart?
Such a rabbinical thing to say.
Such a brilliant thing to say. And then I think he reassures you that no matter what, you're Jewish, he says. Your mother was Jewish, Jewish egg, Jewish woman. But of course, that wasn't the source of your extreme anxiety. That was, you know, maybe a small part of it.
Not any. I had no concern about that. Yeah. He wanted to reassure me that I was still, you know, I was still as Jewish as I had been before, that my son was Jewish. I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about, when he said what story would ease your heart, my response was the true one.
The truth.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Very writerly response. Yeah. And then he goes on to say something profound, which I think surprises you, because I think, I'm thinking that the hardest thing for you to reconcile was that your father, a very observant Orthodox Jew, would ever agree to this, you know, mixing of sperm and so on. And he does give you an explanation. May I read what you say here? He says, I would give your father the credit that he wanted your mother to bear a child. He would have been fulfilling the mitzvah of, help me with the pronunciation.
Pru Urevu.
The first thing God said to Abraham, not this Abraham, be fruitful and multiply. I thought that was profound. I mean, it was so reassuring, was it not, at some level?
Well, it was stunning to me because Orthodoxy for me, and Rabbi Luchstein is an Orthodox rabbi whose father was an Orthodox rabbi, Orthodoxy for me had always been something actually quite, that I experienced as quite strict and rigid and rule-based. So when I was trying to figure out what my father knew or didn't know, I consulted the halacha, which is the body of Jewish law, to try to understand whether it was possible that he could have, you know, moved forth, right? When I met with Rabbi Luchstein, his response was, halacha, you know, like, he was like throwing away the rule book. And he said, if it had been, God forbid, me and my wife, I would have done the same
thing. Amazing, yeah.
So he was really saying, I believe your father knew. I believe your father was at peace with this. He wanted your mother to have a child. He wanted to bring a child into their family. And he even said, because I was confused by you know, my biological father was not Jewish. That was one of the first clues, was that I was 50% Eastern European Ashkenazi and the rest was all Western Europe. He said, no, we would probably would have counseled that the donor be non-Jewish. This gets very complicated. It was like Talmudically, because there would be, you know, obviously no possibility of incest if there was a non-Jewish donor. It was really just in the weeds, but that's what they counseled couples who were Jewish couples who were adopting, mm-hmm. to choose a non-Jewish child and then convert the child. But in my case, there would be no need for conversion because my mother was Jewish. He really got into it.
Wonderful. So, but I think the real reassuring revelation came from your aunt Shirley, your father's sister, who also comes across as an extraordinary figure. And tell us a little bit about the epiphany that she had about your father and the nature of his love.
So I went to, under some duress, to visit my Aunt Shirley, who I was and am very close to. She's my father's younger sister. And I went in large part because I thought I was still on the hunt for what my father knew. And they had been very close, so I thought maybe if he had confided in anyone, it would have been Shirley. And she was at the time 93 and a half years old. I've learned in life that if you're under 2 or over 90, half birthdays become important. So she would want me. She's now 95 and a half years old. But she received me, and we sat in her living room, and I told her the story. And I was shaking. I was so terrified. Not that she would outwardly reject me or anything like... I mean, this is a woman who has upwards of 70 great-grandchildren. You know, family and blood and, you know, all of that is very important to her. And I didn't... I was afraid... She's very kind, so I knew she'd be kind. But I was afraid that I would see something in her eyes, I would intuit, I would notice something that would make me realize that something had changed, mm-hmm. in my telling her that we were not related and that I was not her brother's daughter. And I sort of, I eked out this whole story of what had happened, explaining to a woman in her 90s, you know, DNA testing and, you know, the whole story. And once she heard what I had to say, she grabbed my hand and she said, I'm not giving you up. And you better not be giving me up because you're my brother's daughter. And she spent the rest of the afternoon doing everything she possibly could to ease my heart and console me. And she succeeded. I mean, when I left her home that afternoon, I felt the beginnings of a kind of wholeness, mm-hmm. that had eluded me up until that point. And she and I continue. I mean, she called me when she read Inheritance. She keeps Inheritance on her bedside table. And it's a very meaningful story to me. She said to me that afternoon, you are an instrument here to allow my brother to have expressed the finest kind of love. Mm-hmm. When something isn't yours and you breathe life into it, it becomes yours. And it was just very beautiful. This is how she talks. Yeah. She's a poet. And that was the beginning of a kind of peace for me, because I really am completely at peace with this now. Yeah. And that was the beginning.
I mean, I thought that was a profound insight from someone who's not, you know, Talmudic scholar or something, to say that the kind of love your father had for you far exceeded that of a biological parent. I mean, he had to call on a greater love and give you a greater love and feel a greater love. It really was profound.
The other thing is, I think she understood and intuited how this must feel for me, which is so staggering, because it's very hard to put yourself in the shoes of someone going through something so singular.
Yeah.
And she said to me at one point that afternoon, you are not an accident of history. And I thought, later I thought, how did she know that that's how I felt?
Yeah. If I can read the line that quotes her, it says, It's rare that you get an opportunity in life to stand outside yourself, she says. It's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, am I saying that right, is saying, child, come sit next to me and now look. Finding all this out is a door to discovering what a father really is. It isn't closure. You may not get to have that, but it's an opening to a whole new vista. Profound. Truly profound. I want to talk about the fact that this thing that just happened to you is happening more and more. The more, you know, we do this, I mean, the ethical dilemma, and, you know, mind you, at the time that your parents went through this, there was not even a department of ethics necessarily in medical schools. There is now. But we're just coming to terms with this, and more people are discovering exactly what you've just discovered. And yet, there are anonymous sperm banks out there where people donate sperm anonymously, but there really is no more guarantee of anonymity, is there?
No, there isn't. I mean, even yesterday, I was in Philadelphia, of all places. You know, they greeted me with welcome back. And I was doing an event, and during the Q&A, a woman raised her hand who is a therapist who works in the field of reproductive medicine counseling today. Parents or women who are using egg donors, or parents who are using, it's more egg donors these days than sperm donors for various reasons. But these people are struggling with the idea of whether they're going to disclose to their children. And she asked me if I had any advice for what to say, because she's, in the therapeutic community, they're certain that the only, really psychologically healthy thing to do is to disclose, but parents are very ambivalent about disclosing. And my response was, just tell them that their children are going to find out. Like, leave the ethics out of it. I have a lot of thoughts about the rights of children to know, our own, as much of our own identity as we can. But the fact is that there is no more secrecy. It's not possible anymore. There's no more anonymity and there's no more secrecy. And yet, it's still being practiced. Mm-hmm. So if you go onto the site of a donor agency, either egg donors or sperm donors, you will still see that they are promoting anonymous donation. Mm-hmm. Some donors say that they're open, some donors say that they're anonymous, but they can't be anonymous
they can't
anymore.
Be, right. Yeah.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are writer and memoirist Danny Shapiro, whose book is Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love, and author and professor of medicine, Dr. Abraham Verghese. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And we are the only country in this developed world, for lack of a better way of putting it, who don't have a registry for the number of offspring that a donor can produce. Mm-hmm. All through Europe and Asia, there are registries. And so here, there is none. So you combine that with frozen sperm and with non-disclosure and secrecy. And what you end up with really is a public health crisis, because I encounter many people, because of all of the travel that I've done since Inheritance came out, who discover that they're donor conceived and then discover scores of half-siblings. I have a friend who has 47. And, you think to yourself, what does it mean to be a sibling? It raises so many really complex psychological questions, but also that means that there are many people walking around who don't know that they were conceived in this way, and who may meet each other.
Yes.
And when you fall in love with somebody, you think, you're so familiar to me. I don't really mean to crack a joke about it, but it really is true that there is no There's no system in this country of checks and balances.
No.
And also the lack of registry means that donors don't really have to supply entirely complete or even truthful information.
You know, your biological father, the man who donated sperm anonymously, you know, seems like a very nice person. You know, and he certainly didn't do this out of any malice. I think he did it in the ignorance of the times, not knowing what was coming. But he might by now also have stumbled onto many other people that he contributed sperm to, since we have no idea about the limits that they might have put or might not have put on any one donor.
Well, they didn't tend to put limits, or some places were very forward-thinking and did. Yale, for instance, I was told by someone who was in medical school there at the time that Yale would use a donor, and if a woman became successfully pregnant, that donor got a letter thanking him for his service.
Wow.
And that was an incredibly forward-thinking thing for the people at Yale at the time.
Yeah.
But my biological father, I'm unusual in this way. I mean, I have not, and I know this is probably a question that people wonder about, there have been no half-siblings who have materialized. I really may be the only one. I mean, I was an only child growing up, and I may be like an only donor child.
Yeah.
But it's often the case that there are many, and that
and
that the men who donated believing that they would absolutely always be anonymous and who never would have donated in any other circumstances are being contacted by biological children, and that's one of the things that in bioethics departments is being talked about a lot.
For his sake, I do hope that you know, that you are the only one, because he seems so earnest in, you know, coming to terms with this and getting to know you, being very proud of you, as he should be, and also acknowledging that he's not your father in any sense of the word that it means to you. You've had the experience of traveling to many ethics departments. You came to Stanford. We were delighted to have you. And engaging in ethics discussions around this, do you sense that something is going to change as a result of this?
I hope so. Some of it is very difficult to shift because there's just entire industries that are so entrenched in the way they do things, and it has to shift on the level of legislation ultimately in order for there to be a true shift. I think that there is an evolution in some thinking. I think it's a privilege and kind of an amazement to me that my book is part of that, that people are reading it and it's making them think differently. I can't tell you how many parents have written to me or contacted me, parents who had not disclosed to their now adult children, saying, I read your book and I realized I have to. And I sat down with my adult children and told them. So I think that there is kind of a groundswell and a movement of more, like on the level of families, people becoming more, by necessity, open with each other, which raises all sorts of complexities too, because some people want to know and some people don't, and then there are siblings who discover that they're not actually, you know, full siblings. And but on the level of a registry or it being, you know, France just abolished anonymity. There can be no more anonymous donation.
You certainly can't guarantee it. You cannot
Right, right, but it's now something that is not, okay. It's not legal.
Okay.
And it's an interesting moment in time, because one of the things that people in that industry would say is, but then no one will donate. But in terms of sperm donors, this all is happening at a time where sperm donation is less and less necessary. Because, I mean, male infertility is almost being eradicated because there are ways now of extracting. You know, my father probably would have been able to have a biological child.
And he certainly had a biological child
many years earlier.
Many years before that, when he was younger.
Yeah.
You know, you've taken this memoir on the road and you've been talking about it in many prominent venues, and that's the nature of memoir. But this one, it seems to me, is intensely personal. And I'm just curious, you know, there was a revelation that came in that Ancestry.com report, but and then there was another revelation that I think must have come as you wrote the book, because I think we write in order to understand what we're truly thinking. But what about the journey the last 2 years? What sort of changes do you notice about the way you think about yourself or about ancestry or about your Judaism? I'm just curious where you are right now. Mm.
In terms of my Judaism, I'll start there. I always felt, I said this a little bit before, but I didn't understand why I didn't feel I belonged. And now actually having answers to why people were always saying, you don't look Jewish, or this kind of otherness that I felt because in a way that's what I was being told, I actually feel more Jewish now because those answers have been, those questions have been put to rest. There was a moment, I actually write about this in my memoir, Devotion, where my husband and I were going to a wedding, this is 10 years ago, on my father's side of the family, and it was in Muncie, New York, at this very, very, very religious banquet hall, and, you know, all of the men had black beards and, you know, payases, the curls and black hats. And my husband is Jewish, but he's not observant at all. And usually if you go to something like that you can just pick up a yarmulke in the basket and put it on your head. There was no basket of yarmulkes because no one there would ever have left home without one. You know, and there we are, and I'm in I feel the way I always felt in those situations, which is my skirt's too short, I'm not wearing a wig, I stand out. And we were milling about outside this reception hall, and a car pulled up, and it looked like it was completely misplaced. This couple got out, it was a Volvo with Vermont plates. They looked like they were on their way to, you know, Bennington, and they kind of made the wrong turn, and they ended up at this Orthodox wedding. And they looked kind of, they're wandering around, and they made a beeline for us. And this woman said to me, I'm not sure which door to walk into, what are the customs, and I very proudly, I mean, this is my family, I told her, you know, you go in this door, your husband goes in that door, and she said, oh, I am so glad there are other non-Jewish people at this wedding.
That's beautiful.
And, you know, that was how I lived, and now I just feel like, yeah, okay, I mean, there's such, you asked me before, do I wish on any level that I didn't know, or that I hadn't spit into that vial? You know, on Family Secrets, my podcast, with each guest, and there's these extraordinary stories where we really unpack these sometimes very difficult family secrets. Almost all of my guests have been writers, by the way. At the end, I always ask, do you wish you hadn't known? And not one single person has said, yes, I wish I hadn't known. Not one.
Yeah.
You know, very quick story, but, you know, Abraham and I were together in Sun Valley this summer, the last time we had a public conversation, and after our talk, which was very focused on the Ferris Institute and Philadelphia, I was being taken to sign books, there was a golf cart, and by the golf cart there was a man waiting for me who was in his 80s, and he looked pretty stricken. And he said, I had no idea what this talk was about when I came. And I was a donor at the Farris Institute. At the time, I think in his confusion, he thought I might be his biological daughter. But he and I met later that day and had a drink together. And he said to me, and his eyes were brimming with tears, because it had never been real to him, you know, to go back, like, you know, you donated and then you moved on. And he had children. He was a very, very successful doctor. He said to me, I'm going to do my DNA test because if there are biological children out there, I want them to be able to find me. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Abraham and Danny especially. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were writer and memoirist Danny Shapiro, whose book is Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love, and author and professor of medicine, Dr. Abraham Verghese. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.